Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Windsor, Canada, and earned a BA and an MBA from the University of Windsor. He's a modern-day Horatio Alger story. Beginning as a bagger for AMP, he rose to become the CEO of Chrysler. In 2013, he founded Inkwell LP, a private venture capital fund which offers seed funding, strategic partnerships, and mentorships for startup companies. His name? Tom Lozoya. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Tom Lozoya. Not the Dodgers manager, but the rich Tom Lozoya, the former CEO of Chrysler. Tom, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thanks a lot, Jack.
Can you start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad in Windsor, Canada?
Sure. I grew up in a family of nine children. I had an identical twin brother, Tony. Yeah, we were I was number three. He was four. I was 5 minutes older. I take great pride in that. And grew up in Windsor. My dad was an auto worker. And like I said, nine kids. It was a 900-square-foot home, I remember. And he still is in that home today as we speak. And grew up a loving family, lots of fun. And my dad was on the union side. And, of course, I came on the management side. You know, had a lot of interesting discussions over time. But grew there, went to school there, worked there, and then finally graduated and then went up to Oshawa, Ontario. Started my career with General Motors.
Well, before that, you were a bagger at A&P grocery stores. What did that teach you?
Well, my twin and I, we were 16 when we could start working. We went over to A&P and ran into Mr. Carter. And I guess we looked so much alike, they liked the idea. But they didn't know who was coming into work, which was a lot of fun, too. But I learned a lot there about customers and smiling and having fun at what you do. And, you know, I stayed there even through university days to put enough money away to actually pay for my own schooling. So did my brother. And then we worked in the factories in the summertime. So I liked AMP. Bagging and the people were always having a lot of fun, especially seeing twins. It was always the pride of the day.
Tom, your dad was a union president in Windsor, Local 444, and your grandfather helped start the UAW in Canada.
Yeah. My grandfather, Harry Rooney, a nice Irish name there, came over. And in fact, he got his job at Chrysler right there in Windsor, the assembly plant where we make the minivan. And he stood outside the gates in those days, and they started picking people who would come to work that day or get a job. And the story comes, and the legend was pretty interesting, where they picked him. He said he was a skilled tradesman, but it turned out he really wasn't. He knew a lot of trades, but he wasn't a certified journeyman or anything like that. But management liked him, and his supervisor really liked him. He stuck around, and he decided he was going to get involved in the union movement. And it turned out that he and George Burt in the old days, became an international representative with the UAW. He was thrown in jail for conspiracy, inciting a strike at that plant. And would I be so upset now if they did that? But back then they did it. And went to the Supreme Court of Canada. And, of course, they threw it out because George Burt's case got thrown out. And my grandfather's was thrown out, too. So my dad became the head of the union there. That was a proud moment in the early 80s. And went through the union movement most of his life as well. And, of course, was a lot of fun watching him and proud that he became the head of the union there.
We're talking to Tom Lozoya, former Chrysler CEO. Tom, what's the future of unions in America?
Well, unions are having a tougher go of things, mainly because what the demands are for them with regards to satisfying the needs of the membership. I think the traditional unions are still going to be around forever. I think they're just going to shift in focus of providing more social support in the communities they work in and the people that they represent. I think a lot of money in unions are being spent on political activities, and maybe the money could be better spent on social or other benefit programs for the actual people they represent.
In the early 70s, the Tigers had this phenom one season called Mark the Bird Fidrich. And you had an idea where you were going to get rich off the bird. Tell us that story.
Well, that's a really interesting story. It was one of my first business adventures. Mark the Bird was really, really popular in this area of the country, especially in the Detroit, Windsor, Ontario area. So a buddy of mine from university, we just got started, and his name's Rob. I won't give his last name, mainly because he might not like me telling how he was a great business guy, too. But we decided we can get a lot of T-shirts made here in Detroit. We lived in Windsor, both of us. So Robbie and I go running over to Detroit, get all these Bird the Fidrich T-shirts all screened off, looking pretty good. We get, I don't know, we had two huge boxes of them. We took all the money we had saved and thought this was a great business venture. I brought the boxes home with Robbie in his car, and my dad said, "What's in the boxes?" I said, "These are the Mark the Bird Fidrich T-shirts. Look at these." We pulled them out, and I was really proud. "Hey, man, we're going to sell these and make a lot of money." So my dad said to me, "Hey, Tom, do you have the license from the Detroit Tigers to be able to sell those?" I said, "What do you mean? It's just, you know, we're just selling them in Windsor. This is nothing." "No, no, no. Do you have the license and approval from them to sell them?" I said, "As a matter of fact, we don't." He says, "Well, get them the heck out of my house." He said, I'm going to teach you a real, real good lesson. Integrity and honesty in business is everything. And don't ever forget that." And I've never forgot it ever since. I took them back. We took the replenishment charge to bring inventory back. Took a little bit of a hit. But they were so popular, the guy that printed them off wanted them back. So we didn't lose a lot, but it was a great lesson in life.
I quote now from a USA Today article dated October 24th, 2005, where they're interviewing Frank Lazorda, your dad.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Lazorda says he's proud and a little surprised that his son listened to so much of what he'd taught him. He advised his son to always double-check what he was hearing from managers about the shop floor by talking directly to the workers. "I used to tell him, Tom, don't be afraid of the worker. Talk to the worker. Listen to the worker. He's got nothing to hide, and you'll learn a lot more if you rely on other people."
Well, it's funny because that was really the first time he told me that when I went to union relations or labor relations at the time when I left university and went up to General Motors in Oshawa. That was my job. And working in the factories yourself or working in what I'll call very routine jobs, you learn that, hey, the workforce is pretty good. So I sometimes would go into the plants even disguised. Even when I was running all of manufacturing with a ball cap and coats and stuff like that, just to walk in and find out what the workforce. It gave me the most pleasure as I moved into the organization and moved up. The best fun I ever had in the job was really walking through the plants and saying hello to the people and finding out what was going on.
You were a man ahead of your time. You could have had that reality show about the boss, you know.
Undercover boss.
could be more wealthy. We're talking to Tom Lazorda. When we come back, we'll ask him about his 23-year career at GM. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Tom Lazorda, who joined General Motors in 1977. And over 23 years, he rose to be president of Opel's Eisenach plant in eastern Germany. Tom, tell us about the 23-year career at GM.
Well, it was a big decision leaving university, what company to go to. And, you know, like at the time when I graduated, it was pretty good. You had a lot of opportunities. So I picked GM because it was union relations. And I really remember this first guy. His name was John Lonsberry. He was going to be my boss in union relations. And he pulled up in an old Vega. And it's like smoking like oil. You know, it was the dirtiest looking car I've ever seen. He pulls up. He picked me up at the Holiday Inn there in Oshawa. And I'll never forget it. I says, this is what I got to look forward to, these kind of cars. Anyway, it turned out to be a fun career. Went into the plants, became supervisor out there, learned all the jobs with the workforce. That's where I learned my most touch, is find out what was going on in quality and all that stuff. Spent a lot of time in manufacturing and quality. Then I came to Buick Motor Division in 82 or so, for about 3 years, and then went back and ran Cami Automotive Manufacturing. That was a joint venture with Suzuki in Ingersoll, Ontario, just outside of London, Ontario. Did that, and then I went over to Eisenach, which was probably the most fun I ever had in an international assignment. Was the president of Opel. Eisenach, we launched this plant actually in the former East Germany when the wall went down maybe 18 months before that. Was a lot of fun, and we became one of the most productive and best quality plants in the Opel chain, so we were pretty happy. Then came back to the United States in 1993, and I've been here since, and took over quality, headed up quality for General Motors. That was a good time, and in 2000, I got a call from a headhunter. I never received those calls, and I had restructured a lot of stuff in manufacturing and the central staffs and stuff, and they were trying to determine what are they going to do with me next. I was a vice president, fairly young at the time. And then Chrysler called, and the rest is history. I decided to go take a jump over, and turned out to be a great decision.
You were the architect of Chrysler's Toledo supplier plant in Ohio, which integrated suppliers in a close relationship with Chrysler to develop the Jeep Wrangler. How did that come to be?
Well, it's a great story. What happened was, you know, in those days, you know, a lot of free cash flow and capital is still tough to get. And we walked through the old facility, and it was over 100 years old, the old Jeep plant down in Toledo. You know, some of the areas were just, quite frankly, awful to work in. So I took Dieter Zetsch on a tour one time and said, hey, we got to build a new plant. And he walked through and he said, I think you were right. I think we need to do that. I said, well, here's a business strategy for us. Why don't we get the suppliers to put the money up? And let's say it was about $300, $350 million of capital we wouldn't have to put into the plant. And what we did was we put it into the four-door Wrangler at the time. That's exactly how the four-door Wrangler became to be. And we used that capital. Of course, the Wrangler took off as a four-door. It was really, really hot. Today, it's one of the hottest-selling cars in the world. Lots of high margins there, too. So we got our money back pretty quick, and the suppliers are still operating some sections of that plant. It was a great business story. A lot of the competitors thought we were crazy. But if you're tight on capital, you do innovative things, and that turned out to be one of the most profitable product lines for us.
Tom Lazorda, you're acclaimed as a manufacturing specialist. Talk to us about the future of manufacturing in America.
I'm not going to say I'm a specialist. I like it. I knew a lot about it. And when I retired, I went into venture capital, so I lost a little bit of my touch, but not really. Bottom line, I mean, manufacturing, if you look at what's happened in the last 5 to 7, even 10 years, virtually every auto company has moved to Mexico and have got all the Mexican operations at full capacity. More are announcing around the world to go down there. Two fundamental reasons you go down to Mexico. Number one, you can export cars to Europe duty-free, and you can export them to South Americans, most places in South America, duty-free. Anything built in the United States is being exported to Europe with duties. That's why there isn't a lot of exports going that way. And same with from Europe coming in here, a lot of duties are placed on those cars, not as much as China or Korea or anywhere else. Bottom line, I think America's got to watch, you know, where's the cars being built. When I say North America, it's really Canada and the United States. These plants are full again here in most of the U.S. operations, but I think people won't see brand new plants being built here for a long time. They're getting built in Europe, Asia, in particular China. You'll see Russia plants, and then I think Russia's a real tough go for most companies. And then Mexico will continue to get the bulk of new facilities.
We're talking to Tom Lazorda, who's a modern-day Horatio Elger story. Let's go back to late August 2005. You get a phone call from Dieter on a Saturday. Tell us about that.
Well, this is the time when there was a lot of discussions with regards to the senior leadership of Daimler and what was going to happen with Jürgen Schrempf and whether or not he was going to retire. Dieter just called me on a Saturday in August, late August, as you stated, and he said, "Hey, we're going to Stuttgart." I said, "What are we going for?" He said, "I'll tell you on the plane." Well, Dieter was the best, and I love him to this day. He was one of the best leaders ever in the auto industry and still is. A man of high integrity and one of the most brilliant automotive guys I've met. He knew everything from finance to engineering to marketing. He was just a wonderful man. So we're flying over, and he says, "Oh, by the way, Jürgen Schrempf's going to retire here in September. I'm replacing him, and guess who's replacing me? You." I said, "Oh, God, that sounds pretty good. Good thing I was on a plane. I might have jumped out." But, yeah, we had a lot of fun, and then we met with Jürgen when we got there, and couldn't tell anybody for a couple of days. I told my wife, and she didn't say anything to anybody. Then I got back and told my family and stuff that it would be announced, and it was a pretty proud day for me, my family, more than me. And I looked, that was a great day.
How'd you tell your dad?
I just told him, "Hey, guess what? You won't believe this." Here it is. This is what I was told. And he was really happy. He was really proud of all the kids, you know, regardless of what any of them did or any of us did. But this was really special. And one time he asked me to speak to the retirees chapter. At the time he was retired, of course, in 1982 he retired. And I went over there to talk to the retirees at local 222, or 444, excuse me. The 222 is the guys right across the hall. So they were all there, and I gave a little talk. My dad tried to introduce me. He got choked up a little bit. So I put my arm around him and say, "Hey, what he's trying to say, he's pretty proud." So I had fun with the team there. I think I was there over an hour. And, yeah, that was a proud time for all of us.
You told us about Dieter. Tell us about Wolfgang.
Wolfgang Bernhardt, he came in, it was fun. I started at Chrysler in May of 2000. Dieter and Wolfgang came in October. And there was a lot of change going on at the time. You know, a lot of the leadership of Chrysler at the time were dismissed, fired, and Dieter and Wolfgang were coming in. Wolfgang came in as the chief operating officer and Dieter as the CEO. Wolfgang was this guy, he was just crazy. This guy was so good. He was great with product, and he had so much energy. If we could bottle that, I mean, it was quite frankly amazing. And he had a lot of great ideas, and he really rallied the troops, and we followed him. And he went all over. I mean, he went back from Chrysler, went to VW, and then he went back to Daimler, and he's now heading up their truck division. He's been a good friend for a long time.
Jürgen Schrempf.
Jürgen was a great guy. I didn't know him very well, but I read the same kind of books as everybody else. Was one heck of a big character. Very, very sharp guy. Came through the ranks of sales and service as well, but a brilliant business guy. And in 2004, I actually became the COO of Chrysler and became a member of the board of management, which was a pretty cool way to get to know him. And I watched him in action. And I liked the guy a lot, and he was certainly a big sponsor of mine, along with Dieter. And he ran a big company for a very, very long time and turned it into today's one of the best automotive companies in the world.
We're talking to Tom Lazorda, who grew up in a union household, Windsor, Canada, 900 square feet, 9 children plus mom and dad. When we come back, we'll ask him about the time he met President George W. Bush. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Tom Lazorda. Tom, tell us about the time you met George W. Bush.
Well, I had the privilege of being invited to the White House on a couple of occasions with my colleagues at the time. It was Rick Wagner and Alan Mulally. One time we were there talking about fuel economy and where we were headed on the advanced technologies, hybrids, electric cars, and stuff like that. We brought those out to the White House and had it on the grounds and walked down with George W. Bush, President Bush. Mullally has this, he's such a great guy. There's another guy I love in the auto industry, got to know him pretty well. Had a lot of respect for him. He has his khakis on and his blue sports coat and all that. And I've got a nicer suit than him. Like, I outdressed him, you know, for at least one occasion. He's a great golfer, by the way, too. He beat me badly when I played with him. But anyway, we're there with Bush, and I'm dressed, and Bush turns to me and says, "Hey, man, you got a nice suit there." And I was teasing Alan about his comment to me, but he didn't make one to Alan. But anyway, we saw Bush on another occasion. Well, on that occasion, we're sitting actually in the White House in the nice big room, and here we are. And you know, we've got the president sitting in his normal location, exactly if you watch where President Obama sits, and then beside him was the vice president, and he was falling asleep on us, Cheney. And I'm looking over and I'm saying, "Man, oh man, this must be a nice job. You can sleep when these companies come to talk to you about business." And I look over at Bush a little bit and I kind of shake my head over to see, well, Cheney, he's still sleeping. And Bush kind of shrugs a little bit, and nobody else saw us. But I mean, it's kind of funny how things happen in the in those rooms. Another time we had him when he came and spoke to the about 50 to 70 business leaders, and he had nobody with him, absolutely nobody, and the business roundtable. And we were in the White House area, one of the big rooms, and again, he didn't have any speech writers. He didn't have a speech. He just talked for over 30 minutes and told us what was going on in the world and what was leading. I said, "Man, is that the same guy on TV?" Because he was extremely articulate, very, very bright, and really had a focus. And I said, if the American population ever saw a guy like that talk, rather than when you get in front of the camera, what happens to those... This guy was quite impressive. And by the way, I'm an independent. I vote both Republican and Democrat. So in this particular case, he was quite impressive.
May 1st, 2009, announcement comes out, Tom Lazorda retiring from Chrysler. Why?
Well, that was a big decision. We went through the bankruptcy. I guess I'll step it back a little bit. I was in the December of 2006, and Dieter and I had talked when I went over to Stuttgart in Germany about the future of Chrysler. And he said, "What do you think about selling a Chrysler?" I said, "Boy, that'd be great. I pay so much money to you guys over here, and you don't do much value for us in Chrysler." Almost in a joking way, but it was real. He understood that. I said, "I'm game for it." And then Cerberus came in and bought the company, and they took it over in August 3rd of 2007. And that was the start of a journey. Cerberus pretty much left us alone for the company. Bob Nardelli came in, who's turned out to be another great friend of mine. And then, of course, we ran into trouble like almost many, many companies did, not only in the auto industry, but many went into bankruptcy, and so did we. So I stuck around with it, obviously did a lot of searching around the world to find a partner for us during those times, even in 07, 08, a lot of time in 08 to find a partner. And of course, Fiat was one of them, Sergio Marchionne, the CEO of Fiat. So met with him, and he asked me when he finally got the word that he was going to be taking over the company if I would stick around. And I told him, "You know what, I spent a lot of time in the industry. I sold the company, I work with Cerberus, and I really don't want to repeat it again, you know? It's just time for me to have some fun with my family." Of course, when you go through these troubled times, you don't get much time with anybody. Lost a lot of touch with a lot of friends and stuff. So I told Sergio, "Thank you very much, but it's time for me to move on." And after we filed the bankruptcy, I retired, and 2 hours later we filed. And it's the same day, quite frankly. And still helped the company after that, and played a role even after Fiat bought the company as a bit of an advisor on the sidelines if they needed any interpretation of any of the agreements that were done between the parties, the union, the government, and of course the two entities. So yeah, I had fun doing that. I never got a phone call. I was told I wouldn't, and I didn't. But it was still fun. I do miss the auto industry. Being a board member in one of those companies would be fun one day, but right now I'm having fun.
2013, you found Inkwell LP. Tell us about Inkwell LP.
Well, I was, you know, doing a lot of side things, and one day I decided, hey, why not give back a little bit and set up a venture capital fund where we look at investing in startup companies, you know, real early stage startups. So it turned out I was working on it, and one day Roger Penske's a great friend, talk about a legend in the industry and probably one of the best guys you'll ever, ever meet. He's a great friend. So I went over to see him on a Saturday. He was at the office. He called me the night before. What are you doing tomorrow? He said, what are you up to? And I told him about Inkwell. It's going to be a venture capital fund. I'm going to get going. And I said, have you ever seen the Shark Tank? He said, no. I said, this is what we do, invest in startups. And then we have our own live pitch, just like the Shark Tank, except all the investors are on one side. They're all friends. He said, I'm in. I said, you've never seen it. He said, yeah, but I trust you. I'm in. At least there's one guy that trusted me. And then there's another guy, Ted Fuller, who has a lot of real estate in Birmingham, Michigan. Had dinner with him a couple of days later with his wife, Dolce, and told him the same thing. Have you ever seen Shark Tank? He said, no. So he said, I'm in too. And I said, boy, is this ever easy to raise money? So we got about 12 or 14 of our friends, all close friends, invested in the fund, and we invested in 8 companies last year. We've got a run of about 5 or 6 here that should close in the next 30 days. And then we're launching our second fund. We're still open to some good friends and stuff like that, and we're going to close this fund probably mid part of May or end of May.
www.theinkwell.net.
Correct.
Of those 8 investments last year, let's talk about 2.
Good.
iRule and Cure Launcher.
Sure. Cure Launcher was a very interesting one. In fact, it was probably the record for VCs. I remember meeting the leadership team and the founder and Stephen Goldman. And Stephen came in with his team and he pitched, how do you match patients to clinical trials? And we're talking about patients that have pretty much have tried everything. They may have a rare cancer, they may have a rare blood disease, or any other kind of a medical problem, and really can't get the treatment they really need to save their lives or cure them. So Cure Launcher was launched with their own algorithms to actually determine how can I match those patients with a clinical trial. And if most people in the United States might see it on TV, call 1-800 for this drug and it's free or whatever. There's hundreds of clinical trials going on with new drugs and new ways to do things, and they match those. So they've got contracts now with some of the drug companies to match patients to these clinical trials. We actually met them on a Friday at 2 o'clock, and 12 days later, the money flowed to them. It was $250,000 investment. And the company, Stephen and the team, David, all of them are just doing a great job for us. And for themselves.
We're talking to Tom Lazorda, and I'm Jack Brasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Brasula, and we're with Tom Lazorda, who's Detroit's version of Mark Cuban and the Donald with the Shark Tank. And Inkwell. Tom, how do you select which startups to invest in?
Well, we start off with 3 fundamental criteria. When somebody makes an application, they apply online to the website you gave, and we look at the application, and we determine whether or not it is very disruptive. It has to be disruptive or something that's so new and so creative, we'll say. And then when we look at the idea, we try to find out a little bit about the team, and we actually then do, if we like it, we like the idea, we like the concept, because we think the market's there, we tend to try to focus on companies that we think we can get 10 times our return of our investment over a 5 to 6 year period. That's kind of the going in position. We're finding today that the companies, their leadership are coming from a lot of different sectors, whether it be engineers, whether it be software developers. A lot of them are coming out of the software development side. And what we're also finding, Jack, is that there's not very many people actually making anything anymore. There's this software technology development side of things. Ever since Facebook and Twitter and Google and all these guys on the software side have been doing extremely well. It turns out that the entire generation is focused on, you know, I'll say handheld devices, iPads and everything else, and let's go develop something that somebody else gets for free and we'll hope one day somebody buys us. So we try to stay away from that a little bit, but bottom line is we look for great ideas, great people, and if they know the market and we see some growth there, we'll take a run at them.
I quote you now, age is not a factor, the youth of the idea is.
Yeah, that's...
Is that from Windsor?
Yeah, that sounds like Windsor, right? You know, but that is so true because, you know, you need to be blinded based on the idea. You just got to focus on the idea. It doesn't matter how old or how young or whatever. Some ideas are just fantastic, and that's what we should be focused on. So it's the youthfulness of the idea that we're really zeroed in on. We have some companies, and two in particular, almost three. In fact, it's three. That the founders are definitely in their 60s. That's why I say the youthfulness of the idea is really paramount of what we're doing. The human mind, once challenged to do the impossible, always rises to the occasion. That's one of the old things that I used to always say. Whether you're 15 years old, 20 years old, or 60, it doesn't matter. We'll look at the idea, and if it's great, and if you're a great leader, and you know where you're taking the business, we'll back you. If you don't know, what's going on in the competition, and you think in some companies that apply to us, we ask them if you have any competitors. They say, no, not really, and then we go back. There's 15 pretty good competitors for you, and we kind of walk away, obviously. If you don't know your own numbers and you don't know the market and you don't know the customer, don't come to us.
You and Doreen have two daughters. One of them is in Chicago. You mentioned that young people today aren't making things. Well, one daughter is. She's got a bakery on Division Street.
Yeah, we were just there
Wicker
yesterday.
Park.
Yeah, in Wicker Park in Chicago. It's called A Baker's Tale, T-A-L-E. It's a whimsical bakery. We started that in September. I became the project manager. She's the owner. And I got back to the old days, remind me of AMP, you know, doing all the grunt work and carrying stuff out and all the construction and stuff. It's almost like building these plants. And I had the same challenges with her building a plant that I did with this bakery. You know, people not showing up and all kinds of fun. But yeah, she's been in operation 5 weeks now and having a blast. And my other daughter is a writer, Jacqueline. She's in New York on her way to L.A. here in another couple of weeks. She's 31. She's been there before. Worked at Regency Films in the past, and she's a writer, and she's got some work activity going on in L.A. We're proud of those young women.
Are you giving your daughter gluten-free and vegan recipes for these baked items?
Yeah, can you imagine the recipe I'd hand over? I mean, if nobody would buy it, and they actually put the business out of business. But, yeah, she's getting recipes in that area, and that's a growing trend, so we'll have to flow with the trend.
You've led a magical life. Really a Horatio Alger story. Do you ever pinch yourself?
Well, sometimes I look in the mirror and I say, I got a twin, too. And who's been very successful. Tony had passed away about 3 years ago. But we spend a lot of time together, and I think going back and forth, so proud of each other. And, of course, my wife, Doreen, we've been married over almost 37 years now. So we've had great partnerships personally and, of course, professionally, too. So, yeah, I think it's been pretty good. It was a dream going into, you know, I would say high school. And then working in the factories in the summer taught me I'm not doing this for the rest of my life. I got to do something. I want to go run something one day. And got fortunate enough. And sometimes, obviously, in anybody's life, luck plays a big role. But so does opportunity and taking risks.
People listen to you and they say, wow, this man doesn't have a care in the world. He's so positive. Yet for years in the automotive game. You talk about adversity, and a lot of people are facing adversity today. What's the key to getting through adversity, Tom Lazorda?
Well, I think the adversity is there. It's going to always come back. There's good times and there's bad times. And I just keep saying, if your focus is on the customer, and it's the strongest focus of any company, the quality of the product's great, and the focus of the customer, you can get through anything. Adversity, you have to be brutally honest. Brutally honest. It is the way it is. And I found if you actually told the story without trying to hide the facts. There's a thing about integrity, and then there's a thing about honesty. I always compare the two. Both of them are important values to me in my whole life. Somebody can be honest, but the integrity isn't there. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I could ask somebody a question about what's going on, and they truthfully answered my question. So they were honest with the question. The integrity is to tell me the whole story because I don't know facts that they know, and they don't release them to you, and you find out you get caught later. That's where a lot of adversity comes from. Is your organization's culture has to be where people are going to tell you the full story, not answer to a question.
As our time winds down together, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Well, I think they need to stand for something. And I think there's some fundamental values in an individual as well as how you operate in business. And again, I come back to those two. It's honesty and integrity. That's number one. Number two is follow your dreams. I mean, don't let people say you can't do something. Those who usually tell you you can't get it done are usually the ones that never did it. And follow your dreams and go for it. I mean, what else you got to lose? Life is too short not to have fun at doing something. And then, of course, know your product and what you're trying to get into. If you're getting into a product and if your dreams are becoming a health professional, no matter what level, if that's what you want to do, be proud of what you're doing. I mean, you don't have to be a president of a company to be proud of yourself. And follow your dreams. You want to help people? That's great. That's what I think a lot of people are looking for this guy. Sometimes you don't have to look too far to find out you're having fun at what you're doing right now. And find people you love and keep them close.
Tom Lazorda, what you have done is unbelievable, what you've achieved. But more impressive is the way you've done it with the honesty and the integrity.
Thanks very much, Jack.
Keep it up.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.